It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A federal judge in New York has ruled the New York City Police Department, the largest in the world, illegally and systematically singled out large numbers of blacks and Hispanics under its stop and frisk policy. The judge called for an independent monitor to oversee major changes, including body cameras on some officers. For his part, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said he would appeal the ruling. Bloomberg has defended stop and frisk as a life-saving crime-fighting tool that has dramatically lowered New York City's crime rate. In her decision, Judge Shira Scheindlin concluded, quote, that the city's highest officers have turned a blind eye to the evidence that officers are conducting stops in a racially discriminatory manner, end quote. I'm joined now in Studio A by University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Paul.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can email us at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. Again, our phone number is 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002, if you have a comment or question for our guest, University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. David, the ruling in Floyd versus the City of New York follows a two-month non-jury trial in federal district court in Manhattan earlier this year over the stop and frisk practices. What can you tell us about this case, Floyd versus the City of New York?
Well, Paul, this is one of several cases before Judge Scheindlin and another judge in New York regarding the stop and frisk practices that have been in wide use in New York City for many, many years. Police departments all over the country use stop and frisk. It's a legal tactic. The Supreme Court has blessed it. But there are standards that have to be met, as with any police action. Police have to have reasonable suspicion, fact-based, not hunch-based suspicion about the individual before them, that the person is involved in an ongoing or just completed crime. In order to frisk, they need reasonable suspicion that the person might be armed and dangerous. And what the cases were all about was that the New York City Police Department had expanded again, and then expanded more its use of stop and frisk as a key cornerstone of its crime-fighting initiatives. And they had gone from stopping roughly 100,000 New Yorkers a year in the late 1990s to almost 700,000 by 2011, and a remarkable increase at a time when crime was already falling. So Judge Scheindlin, her testimony about the experiences of some individuals who represented a class of plaintiffs who had been subjected to these stops, black and Latino men. Judge Scheindlin heard testimony from top police brass about what they did, why they did it, what they considered the right kinds of enforcement actions. She heard testimony about the statistics that were presented by both sides as to whether the right people or too many people and the effectiveness and so forth of all of the stop and frisk activity over many years. So she had all of the relevant evidence in front of her.
How do they keep those statistics? Does, for example, do police forces keep a record? If an officer stops and frisks somebody, do they keep a record of that? And do they note whether it is whether the suspect was white or African-American or Hispanic?
Excellent question, Paul. New York City happens to be one of the few places in the country, and for a time it was the only place in the country in terms of big city police departments that kept any records on stop and frisk activity. Officers have been required since well back into the 90s to make a record every time they do a stop and frisk. Now, I'm not naive. I don't believe that it happens every time. But there are, for each time that this happens, an officer is required to fill out a form called a UF-250 that does include the race or ethnic group perceived by the police officer.
Is that just in New York?
It started as just in New York. I've actually just completed and I'm just publishing a new study showing that this practice is spreading to some other large police departments.
What about here in Pittsburgh?
Here in Pittsburgh, we do not have recorded information that is that detailed, certainly not that is released to the public.
Do they at least record a stop and frisk incident?
They do record that, and it is now, given some local legislation that is about 2 years old, it now gets recorded in the yearly Pittsburgh Police Department report. It is not reported out the same way and with the same level of detail as in New York.
And in Pittsburgh, for example, do they break down race and ethnicity of the or even maybe the gender of the people that were stopped and frisked?
There are some breakdowns like that, but you get an overall picture, whereas in New York it is far more detailed.
So that would be one of the things that the judge would be looking at.
Yes.
We've got, you know, she has percentages in front of her that she can see.
Oh, absolutely.
In addition to the testimony.
Yes.
So then it comes down to the question of how does the stop and frisk policy violate the Fourth and the 14th Amendments?
Well, what Judge Scheinland found was that the practice, the regular custom and practice of the police in New York was to target certain groups of people for intense stop and frisk activity. And this targeting of primarily black and Latino young men violated the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. It's fine, she said, to use race as a way to describe a particular suspect. If there's a suspect description, of course, put that description out there if it includes race, and use race as a way to pick up suspects. But to say in general that you can be subject to greater numbers or intensity of stops and frisks of all blacks or all Latinos because they are overrepresented in the arrest data or the offending data, she said, that is unconstitutional discrimination. The other thing she said was the violation of the Fourth Amendment, because in the vast number of records that were before her, she found that in tens of thousands of cases, the police officer involved had no suspicion, no facts, nothing that would have justified a stop and frisk.
And Amendment is unreasonable search and
seizure. Unreasonable search and seizure. And as I said, all they have to have is reasonable suspicion. That's among the lowest standards of evidence in the law. And yet there was nothing in tens of thousands of these. And she found that that was so common, so pervasive, that it violated the Fourth Amendment as a practice. It's not that stop and frisk itself violates the Fourth Amendment. It's the way they were doing it as a kind of policy, unwritten custom, what have you.
And the judge says that this extended beyond the conduct of the police officers, that top police officials acted with deliberate indifference, and that police commanders were content to dismiss allegations of racial profiling as a, quote, myth created by the media, end quote. How much worse does this make it for the proponents of stop and frisk, like the mayor of New York City, who's going to appeal this?
Well, the mayor and the police commissioner and their allies, and they are very convinced that this is an effective tactic that they should be allowed to use in the way that they want to use it. And the judge hasn't said they can't do it. The judge has said it must be reformed. She doesn't have the power to tell them not to do stop and frisk, even if she wanted to. Hmm. The fact that they were indifferent stems from the fact that there have been reports on this. The major report, the first one, came out in 1999, that indicated very clearly these same patterns that the judge saw from all the years forward, showed that black and Latino men were much more likely to be stopped than whites, that when they were stopped, they were actually less likely to be carrying a weapon or contraband than whites. They were more likely to be frisked. It was more likely that force would be involved in their stops than with whites. And so these officials were on notice of this, yet they continued it. They amped it up and amped it up again. They defended Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly Dew as a crime-fighting tool that has stopped murders, and that's simply the more important thing.
And are there when it comes to that idea that, you know, the end justifies the means, that, you know, these laws have been called draconian, some might interpret them as Machiavellian, that if you are preventing crime, then you can infringe on people's constitutional rights, which is really never been tolerated in this country, but in this post 9/11 era, are there statistics to back up the idea that this is stopping that this has helped stop or prevent crime?
The statistics show over the last 20 years that crime in New York has fallen very, very dramatically. But two things you have to remember is that, number one, it's fallen dramatically pretty much everywhere across the country, and many cities are not using intensive stop and frisk as a cornerstone policy. Number two, this was not the only thing that the New York Police Department was doing, not by far. They have many different kinds of initiatives, everything from internal initiatives like the so-called CompStat program to ensure accountability of the command structure to hotspot policing where they pour officers and resources into crime hotspots. It is simply not a viable argument to say that this is what made the difference. There is no evidence that could make that point. What the argument has been is if you don't let us run the show the way we want, including this intensive use of stop and frisk, as Bloomberg said yesterday, crime's going to go through the roof, there'll be murders, people are going to die, the blood will be on the judge's hands, all kinds of inflammatory things. And the numbers just can't support that sort of argument. The practices in other cities that have been successful without this kind of thing have show that it's not necessary. And over the last year, as the judge forced the trial along, the city curtailed its stop and frisk activity. It took it down a significant notch. And the result was not more crime, but crime continued to fall.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris about a couple of issues in the news in the legal world. And one yesterday, the judge in New York, a federal judge, ruling that the New York City Police Department illegally and systematically singled out large numbers of blacks and Hispanics under its stop and frisk policy, and that it violated the constitutional rights of the individuals in many cases who were stopped and frisked. We're talking about this today, David, and this is something that happened in New York City, and yet we're talking about it in Pittsburgh, and I would imagine that there are conversations about this happening all over the country. There is a perception out there, and you hear it from African Americans. I've heard African American individuals talk about this in Pittsburgh. There's a perception of that these kinds of stop and frisk statistics back up a perception that some African Americans call it being pulled over for driving while black. In other words, that nothing suspicious was being done, but that they were being pulled over, stopped, and maybe in some cases searched for the mere fact of being African Americans. As people have believed this to be a policy, now with an instance like this, a ruling like this, does this validate some of the suspicions people have about unequal treatment?
Well, it's a great question. We have to remember first that this case, the facts of this case and the ruling of this case only apply in New York to the NYPD. It was not a ruling about police practices nationally, and
right.
American police departments from Pittsburgh to anywhere else are autonomous. They do not operate with each other. But the point is still a good one. This seems to validate. I know I've heard those same stories and same perceptions that African Americans have across the country, including here in Pittsburgh, that they are the subject of intense and often unwanted attention. It's also important to say that the African American community sometimes feels underpoliced, that they don't get enough police services, that their neighborhoods are dangerous because they don't get the right kind of attention from the police. So this is a very difficult set of questions. It will feed the perception on the part of many among African American citizens that the police give them scrutiny that white people would not get. And if that perception is out there, and I think it is, the perception itself is very damaging because that perception harms the relationship between police and those they serve. And that's not just a matter of political correctness or feeling good. That is a matter of public safety because when the community and the police don't communicate well, when they don't have good relationships, law enforcement suffers. It does not get the information it needs, does not get the cooperation it needs. So it's an issue, even though it's not a legal binding decision here in Pittsburgh. This case raises issues that apply nationwide.
Among the remedies ordered by the judge is a pilot program in which some officers will wear body-worn cameras in an effort to record street encounters. On what basis can a judge order this?
Well, that's a great question as well. The judge has ordered a number of different things in this case. She's ordered an independent monitor to be installed. She's picked the monitor. She's ordered a community-based process in which the reforms will be designed in cooperation with the monitor, the police department, and members of the community. And she's ordered other changes as well. In the context of finding a constitutional violation, a federal judge can say, you will do the following things to correct it. Now, what she did with body-worn video, and I love this idea of body-worn video. I'm the person who's written the very first law review article about body-worn video when I saw this several years ago. And for about the same reasons that the judge likes it here, this can be a real tool for accountability if it records these kinds of encounters. So she can order this just like she could order any other part of the remedy. And what these cameras do is they take a person's eye view of the whole encounter, and it's all video and audio taped, downloaded, secured, and then it can be reviewed later. This keeps misconduct to a minimum, as you might guess, but it also, it turns out in all the test projects, it's a great thing for assuring compliance with the law, because people see this, they don't want to make fools of themselves and violate the law in front of a police officer with a camera. And it usually backs up the police in complaints by civilians. So police usually find after they get used to it that they like it. So I think this is a good idea, and the judge does have the power to order it along with the other changes she has in mind.
And as you mentioned earlier, the judge has insisted that she was not ordering an end to the practice. So in what conditions is stop and frisk still constitutionally permissible?
It is permissible anywhere, any place, any instance, as long as the rules are followed. Those rules are: police are entitled to stop, that is, temporarily detain somebody, anytime they have reasonable, fact-based suspicion about the individual that indicates that that person is involved in an ongoing or just completed offense of any type. They can stop the person and question them. They may also frisk the person, that is, do a pat down of their outer clothing, if and only if there is reasonable suspicion, again, based in facts, that the person may be armed or dangerous. You can't frisk everybody as a matter of course. So as long as those rules are followed and they are applied equally, without statistics that show that it is being just, you know, it's just for certain people, any police department can do this. It's perfectly legal.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. Coming up, we'll look at the major shift in federal sentencing policies announced yesterday by Attorney General Eric Holder. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Attorney General Eric Holder has announced a major shift in federal sentencing policies, targeting long mandatory terms that he said have flooded the nation's prisons with low-level drug offenders and diverted crime-fighting dollars that could be better spent.
Some statutes that mandate inflexible sentences reduce the discretion available to prosecutors, judges, and to juries. Because they oftentimes generate unfairly long sentences, they breed disrespect for the system. When applied indiscriminately, they do not serve public safety. They, and let's be honest, some of the enforcement priorities that we have set have had a destabilizing effect on particular communities, largely poor and of color. And applied inappropriately, they are ultimately counterproductive. This is why I have today mandated a modification of the Justice Department's charging policy so that certain low-level, nonviolent drug offenders who have no ties to large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels will no longer be charged with offenses that impose draconian mandatory minimum sentences.
If Holder's policies are implemented aggressively, they could mark one of the most significant changes in the way the federal criminal justice system handles drug cases since the government declared the war on drugs in the 1980s. Our guest is University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris, and our phone number, if you would like to join the conversation, is 412-246-2002. Again, that's 412-246-2002. We'll welcome in callers momentarily, but David, first, how long have these mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders been around?
The mandatory minimums for drug offenses came into use in the 1980s. There was a project going in the 80s to standardize judicial sentencing in the federal system. There was a strong feeling, and a correct one, that you could have an offender committing an offense and go into courtroom A and get a very light sentence. The same person with the same background, same offense, could go into courtroom B in front of a different judge and get an entirely different sentence. So the idea was to give judges guidelines that would put all the sentences in roughly the same range. That idea was worked up through committees and so forth and went to Congress to see if they would pass it. They did, but they added to it lots of harsh drug-oriented penalties, including the first chunks of these mandatory minimum sentences. So they put the sentencing guidelines in place to limit the discretion of federal judges doing sentences, and at the same time brought these mandatory minimum sentences into the system and hugely jacked up federal penalties for drug offenses. And this meant that if you had a certain amount of drug charged to you in the offense of which you were convicted, you were going to get at least 5 years or at least 10 years, and the judge would have no discretion at all, not even discretion within those guidelines. The judge had to give you the 5, the 10, the 15, whatever it was, regardless of your circumstances, regardless of the fact that maybe everybody would agree that this wasn't just in this individual case. The conviction said it all, and you had a mandatory minimum sentence. Since the 80s with these mandatory minimums, we've been locked into this. And I really mean that, because there is no way out. You're charged with those offenses. You're stuck with them. The judge has to sentence you to those long terms.
And was some of this a part of the crackdown on drugs that we saw become particularly aggressive after the Len Bias case?
Yes, it was. People who remember that name, the Maryland basketball star who died of taking cocaine when he had a heart defect. This was during the Reagan administration and then the Bush administration. President Reagan really renewed Nixon's war on drugs, and those mandatory minimums were a sort of important piece of saying we're going to be tough on the drug menace. Everybody remembers Mrs. Reagan and her famous "just say no" response to drug use. Well, the political response was to put together these mandatory minimum, harsh, long sentences that judges were required to impose. And politician after politician would stand up and propose these, propose longer ones, propose more of them, because it was good for politics. You got lots of people who would vote for you because you were tough on crime. And what we have found over the years, it may be good politics, or at least it was then, but it's not good corrections policy or criminal justice policy. It's terrible social policy, and it turns out it's baffling and terrible economic policy, because now we're stuck with people in jail who everybody agrees don't belong there.
So this part of the so-called war on drugs really hasn't worked.
Oh, not at all. I mean, the famous saying about the war on drugs is, you know, guess what? The drugs have won. I feel for people who are involved in this on the front lines, but I think we know now, we can be sure that we cannot arrest or incarcerate our way out of our drug problems. There are things we can do that are effective to some degree. Treatment is effective with some people. Halfway houses, other kinds of environments where we keep people in their neighborhoods, get them working, get them treatment, get them alternatives. Just warehousing them for years and years does not work, and they come out worse off. In the meantime, their families are destroyed.
And how can the Justice Department sidestep these minimum sentences?
Well, that's a great question, because these are laws, and the Congress has to change the laws to get rid of them. The only thing the Justice Department can do now is simply when it makes its charging decisions. So in other words, when the U.S. Attorney's Office for our district makes charging decisions in drug cases, they will ask, under Attorney General Holder's new guidelines, is this person a nonviolent offender, not involved with dangerous gangs or criminal syndicates or any of that stuff? If so, we are not going to charge the amount of drugs in the indictment, because that's the triggering thing that brings these offenses under the mandatory minimums. If they just say conspiracy to distribute cocaine, the mandatory minimum does not apply. If they say conspiracy to distribute so much, that will trigger the mandatory minimum. So this is effectively the use of prosecutorial discretion to not use laws that are on the books.
So this is what the Attorney General Holder can do on his own.
On his own.
And then what does he need Congress to do?
If they want real action on this, they've got to go to Congress and say, change, fix, and get rid of those mandatory minimum sentences. And there is actually a bill right now in the Congress that's attracted sponsors and support from both Republicans and Democrats that would do this. But I think the idea is, number one, let's make what changes we can right now as the administration. And number two, there's real frustration about getting anything out of the Congress now. I mean, they can't even pass the farm bill, for God's sake. So how are they going to do something like this?
And we'll get to some of the congressional reaction to what Attorney General Holder had to say yesterday. But we want to take your calls and bring you into the conversation with University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris, our number 412-246-2002. Let's go to Tom in Oakmont. Tom, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me. I agree about the absurdity of the war on drugs, but I think this is like hearsay is inadmissible in court, and you're taking hearsay for who's this fellow involved with and who his friends are. I think you're allowed to have any friends you want, and I think basically you have to. The Constitution implies you apply the law evenly, and I think this is totally unconstitutional. I'm sorry.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Tom. You're allowed to have whatever friends you want. You're not allowed, however, to engage in conspiracies to commit crimes with those friends or with anyone else. And that's what gets charged as a crime. Being a member of a gang or working for some kind of a criminal racketeering organization, those are the things that will take a person out of the new Holder guidelines. The evidence has to be there for them to invoke those guidelines, I would assume, like any other guidelines the Attorney General may put out.
I would hope so. I have my doubts whether it'll happen that way, but I just don't like it. Yeah.
Well, and there are we've heard of cases, for example, a former federal appeals court judge, Timothy Lewis, recalled that he once had to sentence a 19-year-old to 10 years in prison for conspiracy for being in a car where drugs were found. And Lewis is a former prosecutor, and he said that the teen, who was African-American, was on course to be the first person in his family to go to college. Instead, Lewis had to send him to prison as the teen turned and screamed to his mother. This sounds like the kind of thing we're trying to eliminate here.
Absolutely,
it is. The Attorney General is trying to eliminate.
Yes, it is. I mean, when you prescribe mandatory minimum sentences, you take the discretion out of the system. Now, discretion can go too far, and that was the point of the original sentencing guidelines. You don't want it to be wildly different sentences just because you happen to get lucky and be in front of Judge A instead of Judge B. But to say you have no discretion, that you can't take account of the circumstances at all, I think we all can see years later what a mistake that is.
412-246-2002, if you'd like to join the conversation with David Harris. David, what will be the tangible result of a fundamental rethinking of the notion of mandatory minimum sentences for drug-related crimes. You said, you know, in many cases we could see people who are nonviolent offenders being sentenced to places where they would get treatment, where they would be close to home, and it would not be for nearly as long a time as some of these mandatory sentences require. But if that happens, what are we going to see? What's the impact going to be on the statistics?
The statistics will change, but they'll change slowly. They'll change over time. You have to remember, Paul, that the federal criminal justice system is actually the smallest part of the overall system. We have 50 states and the District of Columbia that together dwarf the federal criminal justice system in the number of inmates that they hold, the sentences that they give out, and so forth. Interestingly, the states turn out to be far ahead of the federal government on these questions, and that's been driven by fiscal realities. Over the last 5 years, some very conservative states like Texas have done a lot to reform their sentencing systems because they just simply couldn't afford to lock people up and throw away the keys like they have been. So this is going to change both by setting an example for states that have not yet moved and by affecting directly the federal system. The change will be slow, and it's regrettable that it'll be as slow as it is because we've been making these kinds of mistakes, in my estimation, for quite a long time. We need immediate change.
And the Attorney General said that some issues are best handled at the state or local level, and that he has directed federal prosecutors across the country to develop locally tailored guidelines for determining when federal charges should be filed and when they should not.
That's right. This is a very important question because over the last several decades, as the federal war on drugs has amped up, the federal law enforcement agencies have taken ownership of more and more of the large-scale drug trafficking charges and even some of the smaller ones in some places. And I think, again, we now realize that the pendulum swung far too long a distance in that direction. It's time for the states to have their rightful place in the system as well. And most of the drug cases can be handled on that level. They don't need to be federal cases.
Why didn't someone consider this sooner?
It's a great question. And the answer is that plenty of people have. You can read all kinds of academic articles about it, many books about it. But the fact is it takes a little bit of political courage to stand up and say in today's world, we've been going too far with being tough. And it takes a long time for people to get to the point where they say, sure, we want to be tough, but we want to be smart. I mean, we're just not doing the smart things here that we could do to make the system both more effective and less expensive. In that respect, the political leadership is trailing public opinion and the opinions of experts in criminal justice who've been calling for these kinds of changes for a long, long time.
How much of this has to do with rising prison costs?
Oh, it has a ton to do with that. And that's why you saw the action in the states first. I mean, states can't print their own money. They often have requirements for balanced budgets. And so the state governor looks at this and says, oh, my gosh, I guess we can't afford to keep doing this forever. We're going to have to make some changes. It's forced on us. So they have to face fiscal reality in a way that the federal government does not. And that was the prime motivator in many of these states. Whatever the motivation was, it's the right thing to do. And I don't think even if state budgets bounce back, we're going to see mass incarceration on the same scale again.
And when you look at the numbers, there are currently more than 219,000 federal inmates. Almost half the inmates are serving time for drug-related crimes. Now, there is another contrarian point of view on this. Even though there's bipartisan support in Congress from the looks of things, there was this comment from House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, who says that Attorney General Holder, quote, cannot unilaterally ignore the laws or the limits on his executive powers. While the Attorney General has the ability to use prosecutorial discretion in individual cases, that authority does not extend to entire categories of people, end quote. What about Goodlatte's point here?
Well, it's fair to a very limited extent, but it is basically wrong. The legislature does pass laws that the executive must follow. To say that the laws on what has to be charged, that you must charge the highest available offense in every case to the maximum extent you can, that has always been thought of as being within the power of prosecutorial discretion. So Chairman Goodlatte, I think, is just reaching there. He would like for Eric Holder to not be able to make changes on his own, but as a matter of course, like any attorney general can, he can do that. Attorney General Ashcroft, when he was in office, famously said after the 9/11 attacks, he wanted every case charged to the maximum extent possible. And this attorney general is simply taking a different point of view on that with regard to certain small categories of cases. It's absolutely par for the course for any prosecutor or attorney general.
So while Eric Holder is embarking on these initiatives, he is limited in his power. You mentioned earlier the gridlock that we're seeing in Congress, but at some point Congress is going to have to make some decisions on this. When will we see, if not some action, at least some consideration of the concerns that the Attorney General voiced yesterday?
Well, we will see immediate change in the way that U.S. attorneys' offices handle these sorts of low-level drug cases. Those orders go out, and they're to be followed as soon as they can be implemented. As far as changing the actual laws for mandatory minimums, that ball is in Congress's court. I think we all know that it moves slowly when it moves at all now as an institution. You got to be hopeful just in the sense that there is bipartisan support for this, that maybe changes can be made more rapidly than on some other things.
Let's take a call from Carson in Pittsburgh. Carson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, hello. I was driving along, and I pulled over to stop and make a call because I heard I was very interested in what you're talking about, and I noticed that you're referring to nonviolent drug offenses, but you've never used a drug by name. You've never referred to marijuana, which is repeatedly determined to be the safest therapeutic substance known to man. And you've never addressed how medical marijuana in some states and the use of medical marijuana in other states is going to be prosecuted or pursued.
It's an interesting point. There's a lot of turmoil in that right now, as I'm sure you know. Many states now have medical marijuana laws. I was in Illinois last week when the governor signed the latest one in the country. And two states have, in fact, legalized the recreational use of marijuana, Washington State and Colorado. So it's a time of great flux over cannabis drugs. They all remain illegal for any use under federal law. And all we've gotten from the Department of Justice so far is that they are kind of waiting and watching and reserve their right to come in and prosecute when they want. So the uncertainty there is not the best thing. It would be good if the federal and the state systems were in sync. But again, I think this is an example of the people out in the non-Washington world being well ahead of the national leadership when it comes to some of these war on drug questions.
Our guest has been University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. David, as always, thank you so much for helping us work our way through these issues.
It's always a pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll look at the business of beauty salons. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.